For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're in Daniel chapter 1. And last week we just introduced the book, the three strains, the threads, the thematic threads that run through this extraordinary book of prophecy. And we talked about the fact that it's rooted in time, and specifically in the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem that began in 605 BC when Nebuchadnezzar took away the royal family, the aristocrats of Jerusalem, led them naked to Babylon. And then in 586, the city was just laid to siege. It was completely destroyed, including the temple. And Daniel is writing in this period. He is one of the young people who is taken away from Jerusalem. And he's interacting with the questions of why are we here? Why did this happen? He's interacting with the question of how do we live in exile in this foreign place? And he's asking the question, where does it all go from here? How does history unfold? We've seen this incredible cataclysm. To us, it seems like the end of the world, like God's enemies have won. And God, through a series of visions given to Daniel, especially in chapter 7 through 12, assures Daniel that this is what, that the future is under the sovereign control of God, and that he will hear the pleas of his people, that he will act in human history, and that he will accomplish his purposes on the earth. So those are the themes that we are working with in this great book. And the second of those themes is really the focus of our study tonight, namely, how do we live in exile? And so just in context, the Babylonians have led away a number of the remnant who lived in Jerusalem, in the city, the capital city. And then it says in verse 3 that the king, that is Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to present some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles. So he's choosing, he's selecting out sort of the best and the brightest in the population. And it says that these would be youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, intelligent, in every branch of learning, endowed with understanding, who had the ability for serving the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Babylonians. The king appointed for them a daily ration of his choicest food and wine, and appointed them to be educated 3 years, and at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Just a piece of history here. When Babylon took over the Assyrian Empire, which was a brutal empire, which impaled all of its vanquished foes and just slaughtered as many people as they could, and then forced the intermarriage of the rest to erase any kind of ethnic identity, the Babylonians had a different strategy, a different way of empire building, and that was by taking away the best and the brightest of all of the peoples that they conquered, and they would bring them back to enter into the king's personal service. They would be educated, they would be refined, and then they would be sent back as governors in these areas that they were originally from to act as essentially tools of the empire. And so that's the way it worked. And the Romans kind of picked up on this same thing. The Romans did very much the same thing with their ethnarchs. So Daniel and some of his buddies, as it turns out, were some of the young people, probably teenagers at this point, who were selected for this purpose. And it says that they were to be educated for 3 years down in Babylon University, going to get their PhDs. They're going to be experts, it says, in the literature and the language of the Babylonians. And so they're there, they're learning the legal system, which is quite sophisticated with the Babylonians at this time. They had an extensive literature, a religious literature, and even a non-religious literature at this point, an outlook on the world. And they really were trying hard to just take these young minds and enriched them to the extent that they were able over a 3-year period of time, and so that they understood and embraced and began to see the world through the lens of the Babylonian world view, so that they could really be internally Babylonian, even if externally they still looked like Semites, like Jews. And it says, too, that a daily ration of the choicest food and wine was to be given to them. These are people who were put in a privileged place. So they're in the palace. And, you know, they're not living like a refugee. And they are just privy to the best that Babylon has to offer. And so in that way, you know, the king is trying to win them over. He's trying to appeal to them. He's trying to win their favor, as it were. And so all the best food and all the best wine and all the best goings-on of the palace were like open to these young people. And so that's the setting for our discussion tonight. And it says in verse 6 that among the ones chosen from the tribe of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. And so Daniel was called Belshazzar, Hananiah was called Shadrach, Mishael was called Meshach, and Azariah was called Abednego. So what's going on here? What does it mean for these people to live in exile? That's the question. Well, first it means a change of identity. It means, you know, their names are being changed. In the modern world, names don't mean much. And so we call him Sean. And we say he could have just as easily been a Willie. And it wouldn't matter because the name means nothing to us. Jim comes from, ultimately from the Hebrew, Jacob, which means shyster and supplanter. And surely that's not the case with me. We're very far removed from names. But in the ancient world, man, they would name children to reflect certain things about their worldview or personality characteristics that they saw in the children and so forth. Names mean a lot. And so the Babylonians changed the names. Daniel means God is my judge. And that got changed to glorify the god Bel, Belshazzar. The Bel is my provision, my provider. Hananiah means Yahweh is gracious. And so the Babylonians changed that to Nabu is gracious. And Mishael, who is like God, is turned to who is like Molech. And Yahweh has helped is Abednego. Nego is my helper. So what are they doing? They're going right at the heart, you know, what you're called, who you are. And they're really working that identity thing. They want to really reprogram how these people view themselves, what they call each other. All those things really matter. And then not only are their names now changed, but also the socialization that is brought on them, the education, the access to the finest things that Babylon has to offer. And here we see them trying to shape the aspirations, the future. You know, these people have a promising future, Daniel and his buddies do. They're young. And, of course, that's always a question, isn't it, in the mind of young people is, you know, what's going to happen to me? How's my life going to spin out and stuff? Well, that was pretty well taken care of early on because they looked so good that Nebuchadnezzar's like, I'll make your future. And you'll be wealthy, you'll be above your people. Whatever goods the empire has will certainly end up on your plate. And so they're playing to this need for future and for the sense of success. They are playing with their affections, satisfying them with the very best. They're trying to refine their tastes so that they become aware of those tastes and want to maintain those tastes of the finest food, the finest wine, no doubt a good Shiraz. And then, very importantly, they are trying to reorient their whole worldview, how they look at life, how they look at reality. And the thought here is that, look, if we can just get in and mix up that grid a little bit, and so that people begin to look at things differently, which is to say from our perspective and according to the things that we want to accomplish, then we'll have them. We'll have their loyalty. We'll have their heart. And the question of, you know, what is real and all these things, what's true, what's beautiful, who's God, all those big questions, we're just going to assail. We're going to go after, and we're going to change who these people are in the deepest way internally. And there's an important truth here, folks, a very important truth. Are you aware of how our culture fosters a spiritual conformity? Babylon, as the Bible reflects on Babylon, especially in the book of Revelation, chapters 14, 16, and 18, refers to Babylon repeatedly as sort of a picture of a world culture that is very far from God, as a place of corrupt and conforming influences that vies for the loyalty of God's people, that seeks to separate us from our connection with God and to convert us essentially into people who are living for the nerve endings, who are living for pleasure, who are living for the moment, and who have lost that deep sense of who am I and what is it about and what really matters anyway. And we live in a world that is not spiritually neutral, just like Babylon, not spiritually neutral. And there is a conforming influence that is not from God on the thinking, on the value system, on the passions of all of us in this culture. And the thing that really, I think, concerns me so much is that we as Christians so often are unaware of those things that are really seeking to conform us to a way of living and a way of viewing ourselves that are not from God. To be, in the words of Paul, conformed to this world in Romans 12 and verses 1 and 2. And so I just feel like, and this is the framework that Daniel is living in. And yes, it's really clear he's living in this pagan land and that there are these forces that are vying for his heart and stuff. But there also is for us. And I don't want to delve into that. I want us to think about that. We can come back to this a little bit later. Instead, what I want to do is move forward a little bit and think in terms of the alternatives that are there. The alternatives, which would be one, to assimilate. Just to say, okay, this is the new rules. This is where it is. And I'm just going to have to find my faith in the thought form of in the context of the culture that I'm living in. And so I'll just be Babylonian. I'll submit to this conforming influence. I'll just be one of them. I mean, who likes to stick out anyway? It's awkward. Can be embarrassing. And we want to be like everybody else. And so let's just assimilate. Let's be like everybody else. And people are good at that. God's people, sadly, have been very good at that. And just, you know, whatever the culture values, well, that's what we value. Whatever the culture's about, well, we're about that too. And so we just have this desperate desire and that felt need to fit in. But that's not going to be Daniel's example. The other example on the other side of the pendulum, though, would be to separate. And to say, okay, Babylon, bad. God, good. So I'm all over here, and I've become in that way anti-cultural. Anti-cultural. So whatever the culture seems to value, well, I'm going to take my stand and say, that's bad. The culture likes to dance. Dancing's a sin. The culture likes to drink. Drinking is from the devil. And so we just have a whole kind of tradition, and especially among Protestants, in the West and in America, of valuing that we are separate from everybody else and separate to the extent that we become this complete irrelevance to the culture around us. And so we ask here, and I think Daniel gives us the answer to the fact that there is something else, that there is a third way of dealing with the enormous power and pressure of culture to cause us to conform without our assimilating and just aping the culture and being like everyone else on the one hand, or running from the culture and just hiding out in our own little insulated, isolated bubble on the other. And there are two things that we're going to see in Daniel and the decisions that Daniel makes in this chapter. The first is he's going to identify what does it mean to be different. And then secondly, he's going to talk about what does it mean to take that difference and turn it into a blessing and an opportunity to the people that we've been sent to. And I think these are really important lessons for us as Christians, because the Bible describes the life of a Christian as a life of the exile. We are exiles, as it says in Hebrews 12, that like Abraham, we are out. We are seeking that city whose architect and builder is God. We're not at home in this world. We seek the heavenly kingdom. We seek something more. And how do we do that and live in this world? And I think Daniel provides for us just a great picture of what does that look like. See, it says in verse 8 that Daniel made up his mind with respect to all that good food and drink I was describing, that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or wine. He's going to draw the line right there. And it goes on. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander said to Daniel, "Hey, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king." So this guy's got some things invested in their healthy glow. But Daniel said to the overseer whom the commander of the officials appointed over them, "Please test your servant for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's food, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So the official agreed and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier than all the youths that ate the king's food. So the overseer continued to withhold the king's food and wine and fed them only vegetables. Okay, so what's he talking about here? He's talking about being different. Daniel and his buddies want to be different. Okay, and they're representing that through their eating of vegetables and water. And it raises this issue. He says he did not want to defile himself. That's kind of a strong word, to defile yourself. It's like to bring upon your conscience filthiness and to compromise your standards. That's what it means to be defiled. It's really a matter of the conscience that is at stake here for Daniel and his buddies. And I want us to think about that, because this seems to be the place where being different mattered to Daniel and his friends. Matters of conscience, and by that I mean decisions that affect how you live your life before God, who is the audience of one. You know, it's very interesting in this story, Daniel and his buddies don't go advertising that they've become vegetarians. Nobody knows but the four of them and the guy who's responsible for giving them food. They're not protesting. This is not, you know, some sort of a campaign or something like that. This is right, it's left right in the room right here with just us people, knowing that it is not to our peers that we answer. But it is to God that we answer. And that's what a matter of conscience is. It's the issue of, it doesn't matter what my spouse thinks or my neighbor thinks or my boss thinks. I mean, those things do matter. But what really matters and what ultimately matters is, what does God think of this? Is God honored by my decision to live my life this way? That's what a matter of conscience is. And in context, I think it means a few things. Here, we're talking about food. And food as a matter of conscience is a strange thing to many of us, I think. To the Jewish person, of course, it would be could be potentially at least a very significant moral issue. That's why there are kosher laws. But it seems in this particular case that the dietary laws of the Old Testament are not really what's in view. For instance, not drinking wine would never be a problem because wine is not banned by the dietary laws of the Old Testament. That's really not what it's about. Here, we're talking about making a decision that's not necessarily a good versus bad decision, as some conscience decisions really are. Food is one of those things on the authority of Paul in 1 Corinthians 8 that goes in one hole and out the other. It is not of major moral importance. But for Daniel and his friends, it was. And one of the reasons could be that the food that was from the king's table had already been dedicated to the Babylonian gods, and in some superstitious way imbued then with the power of these gods, which would make them kind of, the eating of the food would be in some kind of remote sense almost like worshiping the god. And it's very possible that that is the reason why Daniel and his buddies are making this decision. It's not entirely clear that that's the case, because in chapter 10, verse 3, Daniel says that he's gone on a fast and is no longer drinking the fine meats and wine that he once did. So clearly this is a temporary thing. It was not something characteristic of his whole life, and may then be based on reasons that we don't fully understand. But the point is, again, that it's not necessarily a good versus bad thing. Matters of conscience may relate to us in a lot of ways, in our financial values, in how we connect with our communities, both our physical geographical communities and also our spiritual communities. Matters of conscience are going to involve what kind of way we involve ourselves with our families, our children, and our spouse. How we view work also is a matter of conscience. And all these things, of course, are not matters of good and evil, right or wrong, good or bad. They're much more subtle than that, and they operate on issues of individual conscience before God. And here, I think we're just not good at that in our culture. We're not a conscience-oriented culture. We're a stimulation-oriented culture. We just do because we can, usually without really thinking very much about the question of why. But Daniel is very concerned with those kinds of questions. Perhaps what we're talking about in a matter of conscience is the need to preserve a moral compass and to have some moral clarity in a very confusing time. And here, the decision to not eat meat or drink the wine from the king's table would be a tangible line that Daniel and his buddies are drawing in the sand, and they're saying, we will not go past this point. And so there's that sense of clarity that they have about their own habits, what they are willing to do and what they are not willing to do. And I think here again, that's a very important piece of insight for us. And I wonder, do we have any boundaries at all in our lives, explicit principles that guide important decision making in our life that enable us to live with integrity before God? So, for instance, the things that we were talking about just a second ago, in terms of our financial values, do we have clarity on that? For instance, do we have a commitment in relation to our debt-to-income ratios? Are we prepared to say no to consumer debt? I will not go beyond what I can pay off this month so that I'm not carrying credit card balances that are crippling the average American household to a level of $15,000 and more. See, there are no parameters in our culture for what does that look like. We've got to decide that. And so, for instance, my wife and I had just, you know, decided years ago, we will not take on consumer debt that we can't pay off. If we can't afford it, I don't think we're going to die without it. So we wait until we can. That is a parameter. That's drawing a line that helps us see clearly what we value and what we don't. Family involvements. What kind of time, how much time to spend with my children, with my spouse, things like that, and to be consistent in those areas. And some of us, we don't have any boundaries, and so we've just become, like the rest of our culture, vicariously living through our children, just mindlessly following them to whatever event they seem to be interested in. And we're not leading them, we're indulging them. And as a consequence, we're not helping them. And we've got to be able to make some decisions that might disappoint them for the sake of their good. What kind of family involvements will I have? Will I draw the line in the sand and say, you know, one of the things that's going to characterize the relationship that I have with my children is that we will pray together, especially when they're young. And just to have a framework, not a law that's inviolable or something like that, but to have some boundaries that are healthy that we can express our family's life in. How we view work, I think, is another thing that's very important here. Some of us are not working for a living. We're living to work. Work has become the dominant driver in our life. And so we are willing to give a level of commitment to our work life that if it was not for the sake of money, everyone around us would say that you're a fanatic, that you're joining a cult and you've lost your mind. When the boss says you must be available at all times and work these insanely long hours and stuff like that, and you say, okay. You know, we have to ask ourselves, what am I sacrificing for that? That's a hard question. That's a question that may have implication to my standard of living financially. But it may also open up doors for the things that I really do value, which is real time with my family, where I'm actually awake and have something to give and build a life in my community that matters, serving other people, breaking out of the individualistic narcissism that seeks to conform the American family to its image and to its destruction, and just to learn to make, for the sake of conscience, decisions that we stand on and that we are about. And I'm afraid that most of us in middle-class, upper-middle-class Christian America, well, we just embrace whatever the value of the culture, the corporate culture, whatever it is around us. And we say, that's the norm. That's the way it is. Really? Is it? Who says? At what cost? You know, and so to make courageous decisions here for the sake of our own sanity and our own health as a family, very important. So Daniel is making decisions rooted in conscience. We need to do that as well if we're going to live effectively in this world. There is also the thought that Daniel and his buddies take on a vegetarian diet as a statement of solidarity with their fellow exiles. You know, these guys were treated well. they were, as it says, the beautiful ones, the smart ones, the educable ones, the privileged ones. Well, that's an elite. And the vast majority of people taken into exile lived as all exiles do, as refugees. And it's very possible that Daniel and his buddies are saying, look, we are not going to pump ourselves up and elevate ourselves above our brothers and sisters who are living on vegetables. We identify with them, not with this palace. And we are going to stand our ground to stay connected, to understand them, how they live, what they're about. I was reading this book, I told a few of you about this, that my daughter gave me for Christmas, called The Search for God and Guinness, the beer. And the story, it's a long story, and so I won't bore you with it, but the fact of the matter is that the Guinnesses have, through every generation, have been deeply committed Christians. And so only one child from each of the generation, of course, can be the Guinness guy, right? The head of the company. But so they spawned all these other kinds of things going on, and they each share equally in the profits of the company, which have been massive. The third generation into it, the heir apparent to the chairmanship of the board, the president of the company, one of the Guinness boys, decides, you know, I'm just not cut out for this kind of stuff. I value the company and what it does, but I'm just not that kind of guy. So what he did is he received his inheritance, and he moved into the most violent, stench-filled slum in Dublin with his new bride from aristocracy, and they lived there. And they served there. And they were not going to put their place of privilege and make them be at a distance from everyone else. Awesome. That's amazing. And so it is, you know, we want to move toward where people are and not in this increasingly isolated, comfortable bubble of affluence. Many of us have the capacity to do that. It's just disastrous. And Daniel and his buddies, they would not go there. They wanted to stand in with their brethren. And lastly, and I think this is a very important thing, something I've been kind of struggling with this week as I've had to read this passage and think about it, is that in choosing the vegetable-only diet, Daniel and his buddies were really trusting God, weren't they? They were trusting that God would enable them to stay healthy. Healthy as the people who are eating the meat and drinking the wine and doing all the stuff like that. And it doesn't tell us in the text that at the end of that 10 days, if they look gaunt and skinny and that kind of stuff, that they're going to go on the meat diet. It doesn't say that. And they left their cards out on the table. Here I stand. Apart from this, I can do no other. God help me. Amen. That's Martin Luther. And Daniel is saying the same thing. And they're saying, look, we're stepping out on a limb. We're making our stand. We're needing to trust in God. And that connection between placing yourself at risk, choosing to be out on a limb, what is so important about that is that it enables us to see God work. It's hard to see God work when I'm doing a fine job on my own, thank you. You see what I mean? If we are so self-reliant, if we don't have any real need in our life, if I am sufficient, then we're not going to see God at work because we risk nothing. Daniel was prepared to risk. Is there anything really at stake in your spiritual life? Now, I know many of us know what it's like to really be at that place of trusting God. People in this room here tonight who have suffered life-threatening illnesses and face the possibility of death and of leaving behind children and spouses, and some of us know what it's like to lose jobs, and we've got some things going on. And what I get around there and I talk to people who are at that place, in the vast majority of cases, you know what I'm hearing? I'm hearing it is so amazing to see God at work. It's so amazing to see that these things that I relied on, my health, my job, things like that, and I thought those were the things that were really sustaining me. I was wrong. It's God who's been sustaining me. And He has manifested Himself time and time and time again as I've struggled with these things. And that is where we see God at work. It's when there's something where we have to trust Him. But here's the thing. What about those of us who just, it's not that circumstances are forcing us to trust God. It's that we've got to make decisions in our lives to be at a place where we must trust God. And in doing so, see Him at work. And so there are some tough and scary choices that God will be calling on you to make for the sake of being able to see Him at work in your life. Faith decisions to trust Him, to say no to the things that are not Him, that we rely on for our security, for our sense of control, for our well-being, for our futures, whatever it might be. And this, I just know that this is the life of faith. God is calling on you in an area that's unique to you as a person. Where will you choose to trust me? Where will you take that step of faith that is into the unpredictable and into the unknown simply because you believe that God is calling you to that place? Maybe it's even as we talk here tonight about that risky decision to be generous for the sake of those who have nothing. And really generous in a way that hurts financially. Maybe it is in setting aside my own credo that the Holy Trinity of me, myself, and I is the be-all and end-all, and I'm going to step out and I'm going to deliberately put the needs, the interests of another person, a couple people perhaps, above my own. Consistently, I'm going to commit to pursuing them, to sacrificing for them, to be available, to be God's tool in their life, things like that. And God will, if we come before God, and here's a dangerous prayer. So I dare ya. God, where are you calling on me to take a scary step of trust in you that will enable me to see how great you are? And I think when God's people pray like that, then we begin to see the supernatural. God is at work. And we begin to see it individually, and we see it collectively, and it has this cascading effect where all of us are drawn into the significant things of God. Our confidence is elevated. We're able to pray for deeper things, bigger things, work for greater things in our own life and our corporate life, and God begins to move in a big way. But it all starts right here. And what scary choice is God calling on you to make so that He might manifest His adequacy and His reality in your life tonight? Okay, If we're like this, we're going to be different. But in a good way, not in a weird way. Christians are known for being different, that's true. But it's the main reason why people don't want to be Christians. See? And when we're like Daniel and these guys, we're different, but we're different in a welcoming way, in an awesome way. Then here's the last point. In verse 17, God gave the four men knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom, and Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days specified by the king, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of all of them, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and priests who were in his kingdom. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king in 540 BC. So that's a 65-year role that Daniel is on. Let's just briefly describe this second principle here. We're called to be different. Why? So that we can make a difference. That's why. Not to be weird, not to be odd, but to make a difference. And that's the issue here, is that God blessed Daniel and his buddies. He prevented them from living the life of the refugee like the rest of his buddies. And he blessed them so that they could be a blessing. Just like in the generation before, Jeremiah said, here in Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 7, it says, "Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile." See, Jeremiah is writing. He knows that this captivity is coming. And through him, God says, "Seek the welfare of the city that I've sent you into exile." Don't be resentful. Don't be separatistic. Don't write them off. Seek the welfare of that city and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will have welfare. So there's this great command then. As God has blessed us, He's given us a blessing for a reason, and that reason is that He wants us to be a blessing. How is Daniel blessed? Well, his intellect clearly is brought out in this passage. He's a smart guy. Apparently, he was handsome. He had an aristocratic family connection. He was brought out with the royal family and the people who were close in the royal cadre. He was blessed with incredible opportunity. Well, in a relative sense, folks, there you are. There you are. This is a smart bunch here tonight. Educated, well-fed, overfed, good-looking, relatively. I just want to tell you, you don't deserve any of that. And he didn't do anything to get it. God gave it to you. God gave you your personality, your intellect, your looks, your family, your moment in time, your place on the earth. Those are gifts. Those are his blessing to you. That's very important. And so he calls on us who have been blessed so richly, like ourselves, to then turn around and be a blessing. And it says of Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar found them 10 times better than all these other magicians and sorcerers and weirdos of every stripe. And these guys took seriously the opportunity that God had given to them. They didn't just sit around drinking their Shiraz, eating their filet mignon, doing the thing that they could have done, squandering their moment, but rather, just as Jeremiah wrote, and which Daniel knew, because Daniel, in fact, quotes Jeremiah in chapter 9. He's intimately familiar with his writing. And he sees in Jeremiah 29:7 the prescription for what does it look like to live in exile. To take the opportunity to learn what needs to be learned, to excel so that we can work for the welfare of the city to which we have been sent. And so they mastered the world's wisdom. They mastered the law of the Babylonians. They mastered its religious framework, all these things, without losing the sense of who they were. They didn't lose their identity. You notice it doesn't say Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the book of Daniel. It introduces them that was the names that they were given, but then from there on out, hey, that's what they call us. That's not who we are. And they drew those conscience-based lines that gave them the clarity to sustain real commitment to the things that God had called them to and who they were. And with that, then, they were willing and able to immerse themselves in the learning of the most advanced civilization of their day. And to be people who could be relied on to make a difference for themselves, for their own people, for the sake of really the stability of the region. They were willing to get in there and they were willing to do the work. And there is an important, I think, lesson for us here as well, which is that credible people make God a living option for others. People who take their station in life seriously and who work hard and who are excellent at the things that they do. And we will see this. Daniel and his buddies, you know, they come to the aid of the emperor of Nebuchadnezzar and later of Belshazzar and after that the Persians. And they really are being used by God to create a viable, living, real witness of who God is to those people. And so in that sense, they're like emissaries of God in the places that God has called them. Where has God called you? Well, He's called you to a Christian community. We know that. And we know that that is the focal point of what God is doing in the world. He's gifted us spiritually. He's given us the resources to become excellent in the art of Christian love in the Christian community. And He has also given us secular vocation and a voice in the culture. And it's in that context that God says also, be excellent. Be a witness. In as far as you can work within the framework of your conscience, be the best. Be 10 times better than anybody else. And of course, these things are going to be in dynamic tension with one another. But it's these two things. That's what it means to live in exile. And God is calling on us to have the thought life, the attitude, the outlook of the exile. And it's kind of sweet, as we see, especially from the first 6 chapters. We'll see how this kind of unfolds in an awesome sort of way.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.